WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending 2005 by featuring some of our favorite interviews of the year. George Clooney has two movies that are currently playing in theaters, Good Night and Good Luck and Syriana. Clooney is nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance in Syriana. For Good Night and Good Luck, he's nominated for Best Director and Best Screenplay, which he co-wrote. In January, Good Night and Good Luck will receive the Stanley Kramer Award from the Producers Guild of America. The film is about how journalist Edward R. Murrow challenged Senator Joe McCarthy's tactic of smearing people by accusing them of being communists or associating with communists. At the time, Murrow was hosting the CBS News program See It Now. Murrow and his crew decided to do a program about Lieutenant Milo Radulovich, a U.S. Air Force reservist who was kicked out for being a security risk without being told what the charges were, after he refused to denounce his father and sister who were accused of being communists. In this scene, two Air Force colonels are pressuring Murrow's producer, Fred Friendly, to cancel the broadcast. Friendly is played by George Clooney.
We are going with a story that says that the U.S. Air Force tried Milo Radulovich without one shred of evidence and found him guilty of being a security risk without his constitutional rights.
And you, who also have not seen the evidence, are claiming he's not a security risk. Wouldn't you guess that the people who have seen the contents of that envelope might have a better idea of what makes someone a danger to his country?
Who?
Or do you think
who
it should just
people,
be you
sir?
That decides?
Who are the people? Are they elected? Are they appointed? Do they have an axe to grind? Is it you, sir?
George Clooney in a scene from Good Night and Good Luck. He starred in such films as Ocean's 11, Out of Sight, Three Kings, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and first became famous for his role on ER. His father is the broadcast journalist Nick Clooney, who was a former movie host on the cable channel AMC. George Clooney, welcome to Fresh Air. What did Edward R. Murrow mean to you when you were growing up?
My father was an anchorman and still writes for the newspaper in Kentucky. And broadcast journalism was a big part of our lives growing up. I spent most of my life as a small child on the floor of WKRC newsroom, watching my father put news shows together. He was the news director. He wrote the news. And Murrow and Cronkite were heroes of his because of the two probably great moments in broadcast journalism, which was Cronkite coming back from Vietnam and saying it doesn't work, and Murrow taking on McCarthy, because they changed policy overnight. And for that alone, he was a hero of my father's and therefore a hero of mine.
Now, in the movie, you don't have an actor playing McCarthy. The only time we see him, McCarthy, is through his actual videotapes, through his television appearances, such
as,
you know, the hearings and the videotape that was made for the Edward R. Murrow See It Now broadcast. Yeah. Why did you choose to have him play himself instead of having an actor portray him?
Well, in the film, in the actual story, and we researched everything, I had to treat this like a journalist. I talked to my father about this, and he said, look, if you get anything wrong, you'll be marginalized now. So we did it the old-fashioned way, which is every scene we double-sourced, either through books or through the real people, Joe and Shirley Wishbur, Milo Radulovich, or Don Hewitt, so that we were very careful with the facts. Then we decided to do exactly what Murrow did in his show, which is use McCarthy in his own words, so that, again, you couldn't have someone say, oh, we were making him look too much like a buffoon or too arch. We thought best to let him hang himself.
Now, as an actor and director, talk a little bit about how Murrow looks on TV compared to how McCarthy looks on TV.
Well, that's sort of the beauty of it. It's in a way, the other one of those versions would be Kennedy-Nixon debate, where the simple truth was McCarthy was pretty good at a 30-second soundbite where he could yell and scare people and talk about death and bombs and things like that. But he wasn't handsome, and he certainly wasn't proficient at the new art of television, and Murrow was the best. So that when he demanded equal time, which was 28 minutes and 28 seconds to do his rebuttal, he holds up for about a minute, and then he's also pretty drunk. He slurs and drags on, and is, it's one of, if you see the whole half an hour
he's drunk?
Rebuttal, oh yeah, very drunk. When you see the rebuttal, it's embarrassing. I mean, it's the most unprofessional thing you've ever seen. So it was an interesting, the moment that happened was when they first knew they had him. They were, because the simple truth is, and the funniest thing is, Murrow going after McCarthy is not what hurt McCarthy. McCarthy turning around and accusing Murrow of being a traitor is what hurt McCarthy, because everyone knew that Murrow was the guy at the top of those buildings during the London Blitz. We knew he was a hero. And so the minute you saw those methods when he turns around and calls Murrow the cleverest of the jackal pack of communists, everybody knew that wasn't true.
What did you have to do with the rest of the film to make it consistent with the real video that you had of McCarthy?
The interesting thing was, we weren't trying to Forrest Gump it. We weren't trying to make it look as if both of those things were happening. We weren't trying to match film stock or anything so that it looks like they were standing right next to each other. We had an advantage, which was we were going to shoot it in black and white because we were going to use the original stock footage. But all of the original stock footage is either projected on a projector or on a wall or on a TV screen, so that the match didn't have to be perfect. We were able, in a way, it was a cheat. We were able to use it that way.
The film is so much about faces. You know, the film is shot in pretty high contrast black and white, and there's so many close-ups of faces because it all takes place basically in the office and in the studio. Mm-hmm. And the faces are so interesting to look at. Mm-hmm. They're mostly, you know, mostly middle-aged and slightly younger than that and slightly older than that men, mm-hmm. who are kind of creased and who've lived and who haven't had plastic surgery.
Yeah.
And it's just really wonderful to see these faces.
Well, I think the interesting thing to me was, even in the film, the score I wanted to be silence. Silence was how I would score the film. And the way you do that is by spending time on people's faces, because that's how you can understand suspense. I know when you'd see films like Failsafe or 12 Angry Men, there would be tension came out of these close-ups of people's faces and watching, putting them in a difficult situation and watching them deal with it and watching it play on their face as opposed to hearing them talk about it. Now we talk about everything. Then guys didn't talk about anything. So there was that sort of bravery of, you know, lighting a cigarette and looking at each other and going, all right, Butch, see you later, Sundance, kind of feeling. And I love that. It's a very masculine, probably not great thing to do, but it is very romantic in a way, you know, to watch a couple of people, watching Patty Clarkson and Robert Downey Jr. just looking at each other when they know they've got McCarthy. There's something beautiful about that. It's simple.
Do you see a connection between McCarthy and the culture wars of today? And did that connection inspire you to make the movie?
Sure. I had issues that I thought would be good to debate again. I'm not a journalist. I'm the son of a journalist. I thought it was important to talk about these things because there's been a period of time where no one's been allowed to talk about it without being called unpatriotic. The two issues I thought that were that are represented in the film that are prescient were the responsibility of the Fourth Estate to always question authority, whoever that authority is. It is important and seems important to always constantly remind ourselves that the toughest questions are the most patriotic things to ask. That, and also the idea that I thought it was a good time to talk again about the debate of using fear to erode civil liberties. It was right when the Padilla stuff was happening, when we first started putting this together. And we didn't want to say there's a right or wrong answer to this. We wanted it to be a debate, much like Murrow says you have to find a place where you can protect the rights of the individual and the state at the same time. Padilla was the case that sort of threw it in, along with the Patriot Act and Guantanamo Bay, which was, Padilla, for instance, might very well be a terrorist and might have been planning a dirty bomb. That may all be true. But either you're a prisoner of war and you get Geneva Convention rights, or you're a criminal and you get the writ of habeas corpus. And if you don't get those two things, then we are protecting then I'm worried about the union that we're protecting.
You are one of the, quote, Hollywood liberals who is sometimes attacked by the right. Bill O'Reilly has had a share of comments about you.
Sure.
Do you find it amusing when you are targeted by the right and singled out for criticism because you're a, quote, Hollywood liberal? Or is it disturbing to you?
Well, no, you know, look, if you're going to stick your head out and stick your neck out, you're going to have to take some hits. I don't think anybody in their life has ever accomplished anything that they would be proud of later if they didn't take some criticism for it. Sometimes that criticism is right. The criticism, I would be disturbed if I wasn't 20 years from now able to point back at a point in time and say, this is where I stood and what I believed in, which I think will end up proving to be pretty correct. You know, the strangest thing to me is that the word liberal is a bad word. I'm going to keep saying it and saying it and saying it as often as I can. I don't know where we've stood on the wrong side of social issues. Now, I have many friends who are conservatives, so I'm not knocking conservatives. I have a lot of very good friends who are conservatives. But to have us losing the moral argument when we were the ones who said that women should be allowed to vote and that, you know, blacks should be allowed to vote and sit in the front of the bus, we're the ones who said Vietnam was a mistake. You go down the list of the social issues over a long period of time, we haven't stood on the wrong side of those issues. So I don't understand how we lose the moral argument. I think we're bad at it, us liberals. I think we're pretty weak at it right now.
Not to make an analogy between the terror of the McCarthy era and the friction in our country today with the culture wars, but do you ever feel in Hollywood a kind of, on a smaller level, that people are afraid to talk with each other about things or afraid of things that they've said? Or
there was a period of time.
That,
There was a period of time right after the war, right after 9/11 and the lead up to the war, where it was a very difficult time. There were only a few of us. And if you look at it, there wasn't a senator out there saying, hold on, let's ask some questions. There was a period of time that was tricky. But I thought it was an important time to be talking about it. I don't think there's ever a bad time to ask constitutional questions. Are there tricky times? Is it not compared to 1953 and 54? You know, when people want to compare McCarthyism to this, I always talk about, I think we are evolving. You know, in the beginning, we were burning heretics at the stake and witches at the stake that we disagreed with. And then in 1941, when we were scared, we put up a bunch of Japanese Americans into, you know, detention camps. And we realized, well, that's probably not so good. And then in the 50s, we brought people in front of the Senate subcommittees and in front of the House on Un-American Activities. And we realized that's probably not so great. And now we just have sort of some, you know, some right-wing pundits call us bad names. So I think we're evolving slowly as a country.
My guest is George Clooney. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with George Clooney. Your father ran for Congress from Kentucky in 2004. Mm-hmm. You campaigned for him.
No, I actually didn't.
Oh, I thought you did.
I was very careful not to, actually. I did fundraising for him in places.
Why didn't you want to campaign for your father?
Because I would damage him. Because
you'd damage him?
Sure, absolutely. You know, sometimes you have to take ego out of this. Actors, I think, at times don't understand that. They were already going to paint my father as Hollywood versus the heartland. And my father lived in Kentucky his whole life and certainly isn't Hollywood. But they did. They had a poster of him like a hippie smoking pot. Now, my father is the most straight-laced guy you've ever met. So me campaigning for him in a conservative state would have hurt him. Now, he'd lost anyway, but it would have hurt him pretty badly. Much in the same way that when John Kerry people called and said, come get on the train and ride with us, I said no, even though I wanted him to win badly. I thought that my being there is part of a polarizing effect, and I thought it would hurt. I believe in fundraising, but I also think that you have to find ways to participate without hurting people. You know, I think that, you know, my ideas were to call up the Kerry campaign and say, listen, if you want to show how virile you are, don't snowboard, but go hang off of the side of a building and do Habitat for Humanity, if that's what you want to do. You can't get burned for that. But not to get on board a train and yell about my liberal beliefs, because I don't think it helps. I think it only gives people something to point at.
When you were growing up, your father was on TV. He had his own show. He was a news anchor.
Mm-hmm.
Did your father seem like a different person on camera and off?
No, not really. My father's, I think one of his great qualities is that integrity has been sort of the thing that has always lasted and has lasted into his 70s. He's been the same guy. it's an interesting thing. It's more difficult being the child of someone with that kind of integrity than it's. I'm now thrilled, but you know, when you're a kid, and you're in a state that's still dealing with its own problems with bigotry. We'd be out at dinner, and you'd hear someone say, you know, well, that's about those people, knowing that they were talking about blacks, you know. And my sister and I knew that my dad was going to make a scene and walk out. So we would eat as fast as we could. We'd start to eat quick because my father was going to make a scene. And I remember as a kid always wishing that maybe there was just one time he just pretended not to hear it.
Well, what would he do when he made a scene?
Oh, he'd get up and say, you know, you're an idiot, and how could you say something like that? And, you know, are you from the 1500s? And, you know, he would make a big scene. And I, at times, wished that he hadn't. Now, I couldn't be more proud that he did. And he taught me those same lessons, which are that every time you let that go, every time you don't hear that or you purposefully ignore it just to make things easier for yourself, you are doing a disservice. And so that's why you have to fight those fights.
Your mother was a state beauty pageant winner.
She was Miss Lexington, and she was in the Miss Kentucky, first runner-up in the Miss Kentucky pageant.
Okay, one of the things you've been admired for in your career is your looks. That's one of the many things. What did she teach you about the relative value of being attractive?
You know, my mom is such a beauty, you know, and she's such a sort of... you know, she does all the handiwork around the house. You know, she's a carpenter. She builds things, you know. I suppose the only thing she ever taught was by example, which was that she, you know, she went to work every day and worked very hard. And you never felt as if she was using her looks to gain an upper hand on anything. And I don't know, you know, it's a tricky question to answer, as you know, because it's assuming that you're saying that you're good looking, which I don't like to say or do. On the other hand, you look like a jerk when you go, you know, I was the ugly kid in school. So actually, it's sort of a hard answer to answer without sounding sort of like a jerk.
You grew up on your grandparents had a tobacco farm.
Sure.
So were you near that?
I worked it for years. That's how you made your money in the summer when you're a kid. You know, you start by you're topping it, and then you're chopping it and cutting it and housing it and stripping it later. You could make, you know, $3.50 an hour, so you could make some pretty decent money. But, you know, you don't think of those consequences of tobacco at that point. I had 9 great aunts and uncles, all brothers and sisters. 6 of them died of lung cancer or emphysema. Both my grandparents died of it. I'm not a smoker. I don't, you know, I was concerned with how romantic we made smoking look in the film, and so I put that commercial in just to show how some of the lies that were perpetrated back then about how smoking was actually good for you.
There's a lot of cigarette smoke in your movie.
Yeah.
And Edward O. Murrow died of lung cancer. He was quite a smoker. It's just amazing to see him smoking on camera or even smoking in the hallway of the office. You just can't do that anymore.
Yeah, we were the only set that had people outside the soundstage not smoking.
Did you have to work hard to get the actors to inhale?
No, every actor that we hired I talked to, and literally we brought him in and said, smoke. Because if you can't smoke, you can't smoke. It doesn't look right if you're faking it. And we needed people who could smoke. Because all these guys died of lung cancer, you know, most of them did. It was a pretty brutal time.
George Clooney recorded in October. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. His latest films, Good Night and Good Luck and Syriana, are currently playing in theaters. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring some of our favorite interviews of the year. Let's get back to the interview I recorded in October with George Clooney. He has 2 films in theaters now, Good Night and Good Luck and Syriana. Let's hear a scene from Syriana. The story is based on a memoir by a former CIA agent. Clooney plays a CIA agent based in the Middle East who's being forced out. He tries to hold on to his job until he starts questioning the larger political motives of the agency and the government. In this scene, he's at a security meeting.
And our analysis seems to be on the mark. We're getting good satellite coverage. We're reprogramming resources into
Thank
Iran.
Thank you for coming over, Mr. Barnes. Next. Welcome back, and forgive me if I wade right in, but forgetting for a second your bureaucratic checklist, I'm trying to get undigested information.
well, the best of our ability.
India is now our ally. Russia is now our ally. Even China will be an ally. Everybody between Morocco and Pakistan is the problem. Failed states and failed economies, but Iran is a natural cultural ally of the U.S. Are we going to have a nice, secular, pro-Western, pro-business government?
It's possible. It's complicated.
Of course it is, Mr. Barnes. Thank you for your time.
They let young people march in the street, and the next day they shut down 50 newspapers. But if you satellite dishes up on the roofs, let them have my two dads, that doesn't mean that the Ayatollahs are surrendering one iota of control over that nation.
Mr. Barnes, the reform movement in Iran is one of the president's great hopes for the region and crucial to the petroleum security of the United States.
These gentlemen are with the CLI.
The Committee for the Liberation of Iran, Mr. Barnes.
George Clooney was injured while shooting a scene in Syriana, a scene in which he's tortured. He told me what happened.
The problem was that I'd put on 35 pounds to do the movie in about a month. So already I was in a pretty bad place physically. And then I did a scene that I usually 170 pounds, and I was 208. And it's a scene that I probably could have done at 170 pounds, but shouldn't have done at 208. And I started a series of events which were tearing the dura, which is the wrap around my spine that holds in your spinal fluid. So my back didn't ever hurt. It was my head, and I still go through those. I still have, I've had a bunch of several surgeries, several operations for it. To repair the torn dura.
So spinal fluid leaked out because the dura was torn because, what, you were thrown around in the scene?
I was taped to a chair and getting beaten up, and we did quite a few takes, and then the chair would be kicked over, and I hit my head. And the truth is, usually I'm a jock, I'm an athlete, I'm in pretty good shape. I don't think you should probably put on 38 pounds on purpose when you're 44. You know, maybe when you're younger, you can do it as an actor. It was probably a dumb move on my part, but it was worth it for the film. It's a good, it's a really important film, and it's a good film, and it was important for the role. But it's caused me a tremendous amount of discomfort since then. But you know, it's getting better, and it's a slow process. And if I were to quit and just lay down for 6 months, it'd go away. But I haven't had the chance to do that.
How are you at coping with pain? You know, the difference between pain-free and having pain, big difference.
It's huge. It's very different. You know, people will say, well, you have a high tolerance of pain. I don't know how you relate that to other people's tolerance of pain or what pain is. All I can say is that I've never been through anything like that, and that it was, before the surgery, it was the most unbearable pain I've ever been through. It's literally where you go, well, you'll have to. You know, you'll have to kill yourself at some point. You can't live like this. But once we found out what it was and started to cure it, it's a lot of pain. I don't take painkillers because I worry about that. You know, we've had members of our family who've become very fond of painkillers over the years. But I've had to do a lot of like pain consulting things where you have to sort of go to a guy who basically says, you have to stop missing or longing for the time when your head doesn't hurt. You have to consider it as if you were born and this is how your head felt when you were born, and work from there so that you don't constantly sit around saying, God, I wish my head felt like it used to, because it hasn't and won't for a long period of time.
I read short-term memory was affected by it, and I think at a certain age, your short-term memory is shot anyways.
That's true. And drinking doesn't help.
What are you doing to compensate?
I have to practice. I have to count. You know, I have to do things. I have to literally, it's a muscle. You know, you have to work out. It's not...
Like a short-term memory muscle?
Yeah, basically. What's happened is that I basically bruised my brain. You know, it's bouncing around in your head because it's not being supported by spinal fluid. So I have trouble... like if you ask me a question, I could start to talk and very quickly forget what the question was and forget. And it's frustrating in a way, but most of the time it's because your head hurts, you know, and you start to obsess on that. But mostly what you have to do is practice things. I have to practice, you know, like I count when I, like if I'm on a bicycle, I have to count how many times I pedal and stuff like that. Just not that it's, not that I can't remember it, but that it is part of a repetition that's important.
My guest is George Clooney. He's one of the stars of Syriana. Let's get back to Good Night and Good Luck, which he directed, co-wrote, and co-stars in.
One of the many things I really like about your film is the performance by Diane Reeves, the singer in it. And the music director for your film is Alan Sviridoff, who had been the music director for your Aunt Rosemary Clooney,
right,
who I'm an enormous fan of. I love her recordings. What did her music mean to you when you were growing up? It was not your generation.
No, but I was one of those weird kids, you know. I was listening to...
It wasn't my generation either.
No, that's right. Well, I was listening to Led Zeppelin and I was listening to Nat Cole. You know, I had a very varied growing up because I was on the road with, you know, with them a lot, or I was always exposed to...
Were you
to...
on the road with Rosemary Clooney?
Yeah.
No, I mean with Led Zeppelin? Wait, who were you on the road?
Oh, yeah, exactly. With Led Zeppelin. No, I was on the road. When I was 20, I was Rosemary's driver.
Oh, you know? Right. I see. Yeah.
So I was around that kind of music a lot.
Yeah.
So I got to appreciate Cole Porter and Johnny Mercer. I had a real appreciation of those guys. Sinatra and, you know, Nat King Cole especially, and Rosemary. And Rosemary was having, she was having her comeback at that point. And her comeback was something rather spectacular because she became the singer's singer. Singers adored her and would show up. So there was a great pride in being around her. So I was really exposed to that kind of music. The fun part for me was in putting this band together, Peter Martin, the pianist, is Diane's, works with Diane. But the rest of the guys all played on Rosemary's albums, you know. And it was fun because I got to pick the music and we wrote one of the scenes around How High the Moon when Don Hollenbeck unfortunately killed himself. But the rest of the stuff, you know, the rest of the music was fun because I got to sit down with Alan and go, let's talk about music that we really loved and how to play it and how to do it. And so it was about simplifying things because now everybody likes to show off. I remember asking Rosemary why she's a better singer at 70 than she was at 21. Because she couldn't hold the notes the way she could. She couldn't hit the notes the way... And she said, because I don't have to prove I can sing anymore. And I thought that was a good acting lesson, you know, was not having to show off anymore.
And I know exactly what she was talking about, too, because her voice was basically shot in the last couple of recordings she made, but her phrasing was so beautiful and the emotion was so beautifully conveyed in it.
When you see her taking songs that are normally sort of up-tempoed, like Don't Fence Me In, or and bringing it down to like a quarter of the speed and singing, you know, Straighten Up and Fly Right. It's amazing.
My guest is George Clooney. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Clooney. He became famous for his role on ER as Dr. Douglas Ross. Here's a scene from the 1994 pilot. He's in the ER examining an infant. He suspects the baby has been abused by his mother, who's also in the room.
Look, he's still crying. Why aren't you giving him something?
I can't give him anything until I know the extent of his injuries. And X-ray so we know that he has a skull fracture.
A skull fracture? The babysitter. I never trusted...
Ma'am, your child has multiple contusions that are at least 12 hours old. He has a skull fracture. He also has several old healed fractures. This is a battered child.
Oh. I'm not even going to respond to that. You think I'd harm my child?
Happens all the time.
Look, if you're not going to treat him, I'm taking him home.
No, you're not. Do you have anything to say?
He's my date. Look, I can assure you, whoever you are...
Ross. Dr. Ross.
Well, Dr. Ross, let me tell you, your concerns are unfounded, okay?
How'd he burn his legs?
What?
These marks right here on his legs. Those are healed burn scars. How did that happen?
He... I don't know anything about burns on the legs. I'm beginning to think you're making this up, is what I'm thinking.
Ma'am, you may want to call an attorney.
I am an attorney.
Well, then I'm sure you'll know how the Department of Child Services will handle this.
How dare you speak to me this
way? How dare you treat your child like this? He's a little kid. I try to be understanding in my job. But, lady, this just stinks.
Well, ER, when you got ER, that certainly must have changed your life a lot. I mean, suddenly you were a star, and people become so close to you when you're on TV every week.
Yeah.
There's this kind of bonding that I think people go through.
It's an unusual experience because it's not like being a movie star. You haven't paid $10 and you're 30 feet high and you've made it a date. You know, you've been in their homes every Thursday. So, you know, the truth is I'm a product of a great amount of luck. I create some of that luck because, you know, I did 13 pilots and I did 8 television series before that. But the simple truth is, had I done that exact same show and that exact same role, and we were on Friday night instead of Thursday night at 10, I don't have a film career and I'm not sitting here with you. It requires that kind of luck. The show would never have been as popular on a Friday night as it was on a Thursday night.
You knew something about fame. You know, your father was on TV. Rosemary Clooney, your aunt, was incredibly famous. But what surprised you most when it happened to you? What were you unprepared for?
Well, it's a funny thing. There isn't a real fame school that you can go to and learn, you know. I had probably, if there was anybody, you haven't met many people better prepared for it, because I had the great vision of watching, especially with Rosemary, how big you can get and how quickly it can be taken away. Mm-hmm. And it's not like Rosemary became less of a singer in that period of time, which showed me that it has very little to do with you. And that was an important thing to learn, an important thing to understand, which I did. But the things that you aren't prepared for are the trade-offs. No one wants to hear you complain about them, so you don't complain about them. But I would say that the significant loss of privacy is interesting.
One of the things you've done was try to take on one of the tabloid news shows, mm-hmm. Hard Copy. What provoked you to take a stand and try to tone down the aggressiveness with which the tabloid shows were coming after stars?
Well, I thought it was, I've always dealt with things because I'm the son of a journalist. I thought I had a journalistic argument, which I did, which was that if, it all started in sort of a silly moment. I was sitting eating dinner with a girl and somebody had a video camera on the table next to us and they propped it up on a cork and videotaped it. And the next night, that conversation that I was having with this girl in private at a restaurant was on Hard Copy. And I said, okay, fair enough. I'm going to say you're allowed to do that, even though I think it is an infringement of privacy. Let's just say I'm a public figure, so fair enough. Everything's fair game. However, somebody took that video and Hard Copy bought it. And Hard Copy was owned by Paramount, who also owned
Entertainment Tonight.
Entertainment Tonight. So I called up Entertainment Tonight and I said, listen, I'm not going to do any more of your shows, which you use me to make money and then use that money to buy these videos from these guys. That seems like a fair argument. And a guy named Frank Kelly, who was running the place at the time, said, I'll make you a deal. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, the deal is you'll never appear on Hard Copy if you just drop this right now. And I said, put it in writing. And he did, on Paramount letterhead. Now, this was right when they were putting the ratings on TV, and they thought it was going to be a big deal, you know, TV, PG, and stuff like that. And they thought it was actually going to be much bigger than it was. And everyone was trying to get a news rating, which meant there was a no rating. And Hard Copy was battling heavily to be a news show, which, of course, it isn't. It wasn't. It was an entertainment show. Battling, you know, it was Inside Edition with Bill O'Reilly, in fact, A Current Affair, Hard Copy, American Journal. Those shows were all sort of entertainment shows. So I had this piece of paper that said, we agree that you will never appear on our news show, Hard Copy. About 6 months later, there was this innocuous story, because it couldn't have been, if it was a explosive story, it would have just been me trying to defend myself for the story. It had to be an innocuous story. It was just a shot of me walking down the street with my girlfriend. But it was on Hard Copy. So I called, I sent the letter around, and I said, first of all, you broke your promise, but more important than that is I'm not sure you're allowed to call yourself a news organization and make this promise. I'm fairly sure you can't, in fact. And it ended up on the front page of a lot of newspapers, and they called it a smoking gun. And it ended up being sort of a fun fight. It was all journalistic fight.
When you were, I think, around 13, tell me if I'm wrong with the age, you got for about a year something called Bell's Palsy.
Yes.
Well, the reason why I ask is I've noticed that a lot of artists, writers, actors were disabled and sidelined during a part of their childhood by some kind of, you know, illness or another, and that they were forced to kind of stop doing certain activities and spend more time alone in their bedroom doing whatever you do when you're a kid alone in your room. Did the Bell's palsy put you through a period like that, and did it change you at all? Did it make you...
Sure. Well, what it does is, it's a funny thing, but, you know, you got to remember that up until I was 13 years old, we moved. I went to 5 different grade schools. We moved a lot because my dad had a lot of different jobs. So going from, you actually develop either a good personality about being around people, or my sister had a tougher time with it. You're either comfortable or you're not about being around people. It makes it much more difficult when suddenly half your face is paralyzed and you're going into high school.
Yeah.
So what you become is the joker. It's probably a great thing that it happened to me, because it forced me to engage in a series of making fun of myself. And I think that's an important part of being famous, by the way, which is, you know, you got to get yourself first. You have to, you know, the practical jokes have to be aimed at you. You have to be able to make fun of yourself a lot. I think that that's been one of the issues with some of the some of the liberal bend. Some of my friends, even at times, that take up the fight against Bush, is that they lack some humor, and because of that, it comes off as preaching. And I think that there's other ways of doing it. You know, the traitor issue is a perfect example. I'll give you the best example is, there was this magazine cover, and it had, Sean Penn and Michael Moore and myself and Barbara Streisand and Susan Sarandon and Tim Robinson. It had a picture, not the Globe, but it was one of those magazines that said traitor across our chest. And I got a call from one of these actors. Not one of them, but another actor who I will keep nameless. But he called me and said, who was also on the cover, and called up and said, we have to hold a press conference and say that this is McCarthyism. This is, you know, you can't do this. And I said, look, you can't be talking about freedom of speech, which is what we're talking about, being allowed to say what we want, and then say, but don't say bad things about me. You got to take your hits. I said, let me handle it. Let me do one. And they said, okay. So I took that same cover of the magazine with the same pictures of us on it, and I found other people who were speaking out about the war. The Pope, Pat Buchanan, Bob Novak, Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter. I put them also on that, a traitor right across the Pope's chest. And I sent it to 800 news outlets anonymously with a thing underneath it that said, paid for by the citizens for a free Iraq. You know, I'm for a free Iraq. Folded up and sent it out anonymously and waited. And CBS and Entertainment Tonight eventually picked it up, and they called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I was waiting for that.
Was your name on it? Did they know it was from you?
No, it was completely anonymous. Uh-huh. So when they sent it out, my quote, Entertainment Tonight called and said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And my quote was, the Pope and I can take it, but don't pick on Pat Buchanan. And the trick was, to me, the idea was, you got to do this with some humor. I mean, I remember Michael Moore called me up and he said, have you seen this flyer that's going around? And I said, that's me, Michael. I did that. And he goes, oh, okay, good. So the trick to me was that there had to be some humor to this, because we got to sort of, and you got to take the hits yourself a little bit.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
That was fun.
George Clooney, recorded in October. Tomorrow we'll continue our end-of-the-year series featuring some of our favorite interviews of 2005.